expressing grief and indignation. Then, Ulbricht spoke of the impious forces of terrorism which had caused the president's death. This East German remark paralleled an important fragment of what Moscow had said. The Russians in Pravda wrote that commentators in Dallas linked this crime with the activities of rightist organizations. Well, the London Daily Worker spoke of racialist barbarians in the United States. Now, it is possible to argue that these references to rightist organizations are what have got the world communist press in a bit of a propaganda corner. Because when that story was set in type in Pravda and in the London Daily Worker, it was known only that a white man had been involved as the assassin. Later, when the world learned that the chief suspect had once lived in Russia, where he tried to obtain Soviet citizenship, it was apparently too late to change the implication of the Moscow line and the echoes that spread out through Eastern Europe. And therefore, I think it will be interesting to see what the Soviet propagandists will make of this story tomorrow.
Yes, it's they have got themselves into a corner there. As I guess we both recall, their reactions are not necessarily fast at any time. There has been, as far as you know, I presume, no attempt to recoup or to change the position from the radio services or in the press of that part of the world, has there as yet?
No, I don't believe so, Joe, although the circuit, I'm sorry, is such at this hour of the morning here that I'm not reading you as well as I'd like to.
All right, well, we'll try to get back to you later when you have more for us and when the circuit is better. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
John Chancellor of NBC News in Berlin on the saddened reaction of that city to which Mr. Kennedy went and in which he pronounced that he was a Berliner, meaning, of course, that he had joined these people fighting for their freedom, and the saddened reaction of Mayor Willy Brandt, a great friend to America, and to Mr. Kennedy. There are items coming in from all over the world, and there are other things that we want to talk to, too. And people that we want to talk to. I think we can bring you up to date on the latest, on the actual details before we go on with these things. NBC's Tom Pettit is in Dallas. We, on the latest in connection with the police activities there, we go now to Tom Pettit in Dallas.
Dallas Police Chief J.E. Curry says, "I believe we have the right man." He is discussing 24-year-old Lee Oswald, prime suspect in the assassination of President Kennedy. Questioning of Oswald has been suspended briefly while paraffin tests are run to determine if he is linked with the rifle believed to be the murder weapon. Oswald earlier was charged with the murder of police officer J.D. Tippett, who had gone to apprehend Oswald. But he denies killing President Kennedy, says he is being held because he was in Russia. Tom Pettit, NBC News at Dallas Police Headquarters.
Now, looking at items in connection with both the sad affair and with the future. From China, by the way, the other part of the communist world, there was absolutely no reaction of any kind so far this morning. There are no American correspondents, of course, allowed in Red China. The Reuters news agency is there. Their correspondent reports that there was absolutely no attention given. The news came too late for morning papers, but early morning news broadcasts also ignored the story. In answer to questions, the foreign ministry said its reaction to the news would be made known when it was available. And when that sort of statement is made in Red China, the Reuters correspondent there is extremely careful not to challenge it too much if he wants to stay. Diplomats spent the morning glued to radio sets listening to shortwave foreign news broadcasts. Mr. Kennedy's death is unlikely to cause much sorrow, says Reuters, among the communist Chinese, or to cause a halt to continuous attacks on United States policy. Earlier this week, a major Communist Party statement referred to the late president as, quote, the wildest militarist of all times, the wildest plotters of a new world war, and the most ferocious enemy of world peace, which is about as much of an accolade, perhaps, as the president could have hoped to have received. The new president, Mr. Johnson, what about him? We spoke of the vast numbers of problems that he faced, just the ones that came up in one news conference, these questions of world scope involving our country and its tremendous place, its tremendous problems in the world, and our problems at home, with which Mr. Kennedy had been suffering and striving so greatly. Here is something on Mr. Kennedy's own background, and it shows him as a man eminently equipped to assailed this post. Lyndon Johnson is the 8th American vice president to succeed to the White House on the death of a president, the 4th to gain this position by an assassination. He is 55 years old. He is a Texan. He was chosen by the slain President Kennedy for second place on the 1960 Democratic ticket to strengthen it in the South. And he is credited with holding some of the southern states for Kennedy in the paper-thin Democratic victory 3 years ago. Before he became vice president, Mr. Johnson was Democratic leader of the Senate and was regarded as one of the most skillful strategists ever to function in Congress. As vice president, he did little to intrude on the jealously guarded prerogatives of Congress. I think this is one of the important things to remember. We cannot help but discuss what is going to happen on the morrow, because this is the situation. Our country must continue to go on. President Kennedy has died, but the United States is here and its problems remain. And Mr. Kennedy, as a skilled leader in the Senate, as the man who was tremendously respected there and who was followed by various coalitions, despite the fact that the Democratic-Republican split was great, is a man who can be expected to have a substantial influence there. Only to a certain degree, however, since the Senate continues to jealously guard its prerogatives, as Mr. Johnson himself displayed. On several occasions, as a matter of fact, during his vice presidency, the question was asked sometimes of him directly and sometimes in public meetings, why Mr. Johnson, with all of his intimate knowledge of each of the senators of the United States, didn't do something to push this or that piece of legislation, which the administration wanted badly to seem to be made into law. And the answer always was that Mr. Johnson knew, because of this very experience to which people referred, that trying to push the Senate, which is so carefully guarding its prerogatives, is a very dangerous thing to do and will probably cause an evil reaction rather than a good one. It remains to be seen whether he will be more successful than Mr. Kennedy was in getting action from this Congress, which has been a Congress most difficult to deal with in many areas so far as the president's most important programs are concerned. He presumably will replace some, perhaps many, of the cabinet members and other White House advisors with men of his own choice. This is not necessarily a condemnation, insofar as Mr. Johnson is concerned, of the men who are in the cabinet, but you must remember that our system of government differs greatly from that of parliamentary countries such as Great Britain. In our country, the cabinet members are responsible directly to the president. Under the Constitution, they really have very little legal existence. The president must assume responsibility for all of the actions of members of his cabinet, and so they must be not merely men that he can respect, but men with whom he is certain he can work. Now, this can devolve to a matter of personalities. It would seem that Mr. McNamara, the Secretary of Defense, would be one of those who will stay if he cares to, because Mr. Johnson has many times expressed his tremendous respect for Mr. McNamara and has spoken of him as the strongest man in the cabinet. The course that we mentioned of changing members of the cabinet was followed by former President Harry Truman after he succeeded Franklin Delano Roosevelt in the White House on April 12, 1945. Mr. Kennedy was the first president to fall to an assassin's bullet since the creation of the Secret Service to protect presidents after the assassination of William McKinley in 1901. It reminds me of this, too. I spent a good part of this day out on the streets of this city, and you can't get away from the fact that a lot of people were saying, where was the Secret Service? I have followed presidents of the United States on tours through several countries and through this one. I followed Mr. Khrushchev on his tour here and in France and in Indonesia and in India. And after this, and having talked to many people from the Secret Services of countries all over the world, some of them countries in which there is much less freedom than here, we always came to the same conclusion, that if there is a man with sufficient intelligence and determination and skill, no Secret Service of any kind in any country can prevent his death. And that, of course, is what has shocked America today. The death of a president sends shockwaves through government and the nation, even though his successor is a member of the same political party. And it was a shock to Mr. Truman, you'll remember, who took his apprenticeship in Congress, as did Mr. Kennedy and Mr. Johnson. I felt like the moon, the stars, and all the planets had fallen on me, Mr. Truman said a day after he was sworn in. I've got the most terrible, responsible job a man ever had. Speaking of Mr. Truman, he issued a statement today. We have that statement at this moment, and I'll give it to you in just a moment. It is time that we break, and we shall be returning to you in just a few seconds.
The NBC Radio Network will stay on the air with continuous coverage until 1 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. We will resume broadcasting at 7:30 a.m. Eastern Standard Time Saturday, tomorrow, with continuous coverage. We pause 10 seconds for station identification.
The Detroit news stations, WWJ and WWJ-FM, Detroit.
This is Don Perry of WWJ News. Detroit, along with the rest of the nation, was stunned today by the assassination of President Kennedy. There is an air of disbelief, even now, several hours after the tragic news came from Dallas, Texas. The big and the little mourn the death of Mr. Kennedy, who started his campaign for the nation's highest office right here in Detroit in 1960. When the first bulletin of the shooting was broadcast shortly after 1:30 this afternoon, hundreds of persons called the Detroit News and WWJ News as switchboards were jammed throughout the city. 1,123 calls were registered at the Detroit News switchboard between 1:30 and 4 o'clock. Hundreds of others could not get through. The telephone jam became so bad, Martin Hayden, editor of the Detroit News, was forced to ask radio and television to plead with listeners not to call for information. All city offices in Detroit closed at 2:45 this afternoon, with the exception of the essential services such as fire and police and health and welfare agencies. Mayor Kavanaugh, through his press secretary, told the employees to spend their time going to church to pray for the president. The mayor had called from home, where he is recovering from a heavy cold. Later, Mayor Kavanaugh made this statement.
I'm sure I speak for all of us here in Detroit when I say I'm literally grief-stricken over what's happened to our beloved president. To be struck down in the way in which he was in this hour of tragedy is almost unbelievable. It's a great personal loss for myself, my wife and family, because we've had the pleasure of meeting and knowing the president, President Kennedy. It's just unbelievable and incomprehensible that this could happen. And I would extend our most profound sorrow on not only behalf of my family, but on behalf of everyone here in Detroit, to Mrs. Kennedy and her bereaved family, as well as to Vice President Johnson, sending him our prayers in this great hour of need. I've asked that the public buildings be draped in black to commemorate this very tragic day, and also that our flags be flown at half-mast throughout the city. I truly am grief-stricken, and from the deep sorrow in my heart, I would extend most deep and profound sympathy to Mrs. Kennedy and her family.
The mayor sent a telegram to President Johnson, which said, in part, "As you assume the mantle of leadership, do so in the firm knowledge that America needs and acclaims your leadership. May God be with you." The reaction of the man and woman on the street was of shock, disbelief, and bitter sorrow. People went about their business, or tried to, choking back tears and shaking their heads, wondering how such a thing could happen here in the United States.
Well, I think it's about the worst news I've heard in a number of years. The most tragic thing. It just almost breaks my heart.
It was a terrible blow to the whole country, news of the president's death.
Well, I'm terribly stunned, and my prayers certainly go with the Kennedy family, and I hate to see something like this happen in our era and age, to think that it'd be such a tragedy. I just hope that, everything will turn out all right for our country. And I do feel very sad about this. And as I say, my prayers are with the people who were involved, Mrs. Kennedy and the Kennedy family.
I was too much excited. I think it's a terrible thing. And personally, I feel that it is nothing to do with the Republican or the communist. I think it's something else. Political issues in the United States, but I don't think it has anything to do with the communist movement in this country or any blame on Republican Party. It could be internal issues.
It's mostly shock or amazement that something like this could happen or it happened here. I think everyone felt at first that it didn't happen. And as the news broadcast came out and we realized it was happening, then we just settled down to, well, we just don't know. It's just something we can't put into words. At least I couldn't put it into words at all.
Governor Romney flew back to Michigan tonight from Omaha, Nebraska, as a result of the assassination of the president. The Midwestern Conference of Governors, which Mr. Romney was attending at Omaha, was canceled immediately when the news was heard. Governor Romney was grim-faced as he stepped off a plane in a rainstorm at Lansing tonight. He told newsmen he felt numb, and he added, quote, "I guess we all feel that way." Governor Romney's Air National Guard plane had difficulty landing in the storm. Winds gusting up to 35 miles an hour were raking the Lansing area at the time. The plane landed on its second pass at Lansing's capital city airport. With the governor out of the state this afternoon, Acting Governor T. John Lisinski ordered all state offices closed for the afternoon in mourning for the death of the president. Governor Romney sent the following telegram to President Johnson at the White House in Washington tonight. "You can be certain of my wholehearted support during this critical time and my personal prayers for your strength and guidance as you have assumed your staggering burden." The governor and Mrs. Romney also sent the following telegram to Mrs. Kennedy. "With the peoples of the world and our nation, all of us in Michigan weep with you. For your personal sorrow as wife and mother, and for your dear babies, Mrs. Romney and I are praying that the Comforter may attend you and bring you strength." The governor is now en route to his home in Bloomfield Hills. He left his office at 10 o'clock tonight. Sometime tomorrow morning, he will leave Detroit by private plane with Mrs. Romney for Washington to view the president's body at the White House tomorrow afternoon. The governor had wanted to attend the High Mass at Blessed Sacrament Cathedral in Detroit. He expressed his regrets that he would not be able to attend the Mass because of the travel arrangements to Washington. He designated three of his staff members to represent him at the services. They are Richard C. Van Dusen, his legal advisor, Richard L. Milliman, the governor's press secretary, and Miss Marjorie McGowan, assistant legal advisor. The governor and Mrs. Romney will remain in Washington through the services on Monday, returning to Michigan Monday night. Former Democratic Governor John B. Swainson saw the president in Washington less than a month ago. Mr. Swainson had this reaction to the president's death.
"It's very difficult to speak today and at this particular time. The events reported from Dallas are uniquely an American tragedy. President John F. Kennedy has truly given his life for his country. It's unbelievable that this could happen in the United States in 1963. What goes through your mind at a time like this, of course, is a very individual thing. It was my great pleasure and honor to serve as the governor of the state of Michigan during the administration of John F. Kennedy. I knew the man personally, his family. I saw him while I was in Washington, spoke with him just about 1 month ago. He was a very human person, yet a man of great intellectual attainments. He's a man that also understood the drives and desires of individual people. It's probably significant that his assassination today occurs almost 100 years to the year of the assassination of President Lincoln. And probably many historians will draw significance from the fact that the issues 100 years ago were probably just as violent, just as much of a matter of concern to all Americans as they are today. This is a great tragedy, not only for the president's family and his friends, but for all of the citizens of the United States."
President Kennedy was in Michigan three times during the 1960 campaign. On Labor Day, he talked to more than 70,000 persons from the square in front of City Hall, the same spot where former President Harry S. Truman started his campaign in 1948. At the height of the 1960 campaign, Mr. Kennedy again appeared in the state. This time, he made a whistle-stop tour through 10 Michigan cities shortly before the election. From Washington, the following statement was made today from the office of Michigan Senator Patrick McNamara.
This is Robert Perrin, administrative assistant to Senator McNamara. On learning of the shooting of President Kennedy, the senator issued this brief statement. I quote, "This was an incredible and barbaric act of violence. Our prayers were with President Kennedy in his struggle for life, and they are now with the new president."
Michigan Republican Congressman George Meader said, quote, "I am shocked and horrified at the news. It is almost unbelievable that an event of this kind could take place in America in this day and age," unquote. Michigan Senator Philip Hart had this reaction.
"I think everybody, all of us, are burdened by this sense of despair and helplessness. Certainly there is one appropriate thing for all of us to do, that's offer a prayer for the late president, and a prayer for this country."
Former Governor G. Menin Williams said, "It is hard to believe that President Kennedy is dead. It's a personal shock and loss to me, as it is to multitudes in our country and around the world. No man in recent times so affected the lives and aspirations of the people of our country and the world." There was also an expression of sympathy, shock, and disbelief from Peter Spivak, chairman of the Wayne County Republican Party.
"Today, someone or some group of persons as yet unknown, filled with some kind of a hate that passes, I'm sure, most of our understandings, have cut down the President of the United States. They've cut down a man who, more than many men, could have taken the easy way in life, but instead dedicated his life to public service. The sympathy which all of us extend to his family and his friends and to the new President Johnson and his family won't be enough. The job that needs to be done is for all of us to dedicate ourselves to fighting whatever cancer it was that produced this hateful deed in our society. And we must not rest until that is done. Tonight, in your prayers, remember not only the President's family, but President Johnson and all the millions of people in this world to whom the United States and its president meant a hope of freedom. And remember that we must wipe out whatever the cancer that gnawed at the insides of someone or some people and perpetrated this vile and hateful act on mankind's conscience today."
Religious leaders of all faiths deplored the assassination. The Most Reverend Bishop Henry Donnelly of the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of Detroit scheduled a Mass at Blessed Sacrament Cathedral for 11 o'clock tomorrow morning. Leaders of all faiths urge prayers for Mr. Kennedy. There were numerous cancellations and reschedulings of public events around the Detroit area tonight. The Ice Follies canceled this evening's performance at Olympia Stadium. Those holding tickets for tonight's show may use them at either of two performances on Saturday or Sunday. The New York Opera Company performance of La Boheme at Masonic Temple Auditorium was rescheduled for December 8th. The Mercy College concert at Ford Auditorium was canceled and rescheduled at a later date to be announced. The Midwest Photo Show at the Light Guard Armory canceled the entertainment part of tonight's program, but Saturday and Sunday's programs will go on as scheduled. The Jefferson PTA and Wyandotte announced that tonight's show will be rescheduled to Monday night. Tomorrow night's performance will be held. The Fisher Theater canceled tonight's performance. Tomorrow afternoon and tomorrow evening's performances will go on as usual. The Birmingham Public Schools canceled this evening's activities, and the Armenian Cultural Center also canceled its activities tonight. The Morton Silverman Post of the Jewish War Veterans announced cancellation of their affair for Saturday night. The Wayne County Democratic Women's Day, scheduled for tomorrow at the Lee Plaza Hotel in Detroit, also has been canceled. The Detroit Federation of Teachers has postponed the scheduled demonstration march on the Detroit Board of Education on Tuesday. Big Ten Commissioner Bill Reed announced that the game will go on as scheduled between Michigan State and Illinois. Governor Romney had asked that it be canceled, but MSU President John Hanna said he didn't think the school should cancel since the Illinois team was already in Lansing. Ceremonies for the late president will be held at halftime. The Michigan-Ohio State game will also go on as scheduled in Ann Arbor. Two games were canceled, the Purdue-Indiana game and the Wisconsin-Minnesota contest. In pro basketball, tonight's game at Cincinnati with Detroit and Cincinnati was called off. The Goodfellow football game at Tiger Stadium went on as scheduled tonight, and the game was won by Denby over Notre Dame 7-0. All television coverage of college and pro football over the weekend has been canceled. There were these further observations on the reaction to the president's death. At the Conference on Arms and Disarmament at Rackham Memorial Building, there were an estimated 300 persons in the audience today. Somehow, word that the president had been assassinated became known in the rear of the room, but it flowed through to the front like an electric impulse. It reached the platform where the sad announcement was made. There were moans, a few women became hysterical, men wept openly, and a professor who had been making a speech critical of the Kennedy economic policies walked from the platform weeping. All flags on Detroit city buildings were lowered to half-mast. Black mourning cloth was draped around the Spirit of Detroit statue in front of the city county building, and mourning wreaths were placed at the building's four entrances. No words can describe the shock of this day, unless they might be the four words that went up this afternoon on a sign along the expressway. In God we trust. This is Don Perry, WWJ News. Now back to NBC.
The Cuban invasion, which was staged by dissident exile groups, and there was vast dispute over the extent the United States had promised aid and the extent to which it should have, under any circumstances, given aid. In 1962, in October, he forced Russia to withdraw its missiles, the missiles that it had secreted in Cuba with atomic warheads, and all of the world breathed a sigh of relief. In 1964, he was assassinated on November 22nd. This, a very brief thumbnail sketch, certainly not satisfactory, but there'll be more in this area later. Overseas, our friends have been mourning with us, those who admired the president, other chiefs of state. The BBC this afternoon, or rather this evening, had a tribute to Mr. Kennedy, which was begun by the prime minister, conservative prime minister, Sir Alexander Douglas Hume.
In 3 short years of his presidency, he left an indelible mark on his country and on the world. And for us in Britain, his loss is a deep and a sad one, because he was the most loyal and faithful of allies. Tonight, I fear, there is no comfort that I can bring to the American people, nor indeed to ourselves, nor indeed to men anywhere who care for tolerance and liberty and justice and peace, unless it be this, that this dreadful deed should shock us all to dedicate ourselves anew to those things which he liked, which he loved, and for which he worked during his life. And if we can help to bring to men the liberty, justice, and peace for which he did so much, then we shall be doing something to serve the causes in the service of which he himself died.
Now, waiting in our Manchester studio is Mr. Harold Wilson, the leader of the opposition.
The Prime Minister, I think, spoke for all of us when he expressed the deep sympathy of this nation, of our people, to Mrs. Kennedy, her family, to his relatives and his associates in the American government on this tragic, this senseless act that has taken place today. It has come as a tremendous shock to everyone in this country. When I heard the news, I was addressing a large meeting, and when it was announced, all the people in the hall let out an involuntary gasp of horror. And as they stood in sympathy, in tribute to President Kennedy, one could sense that they were almost stunned by what they had heard. Like the Prime Minister, all of us who had the privilege of knowing President Kennedy will think, I think, perhaps first of the man. He was young and vigorous. When you talked to him in the White House, even though you were all the time conscious that you were talking to a man who wielded enormous power and tremendous responsibility, the talk itself was as intimate and frank and as free as if you were talking at your own fireside. He had a very rapid grasp of any subject that one was discussing, and we knew that he had, of course, behind his words, a remarkable knowledge based on the briefing that he had from that vast administrative machine. Above all, he gave a sense of vigor and of purpose to everything that he did. I know a good number of his associates. Some of them I've known for many years, and on my visits to Washington, I've been able to sense from them the tremendous inspiration and, above all, the sense of mission and of purpose that he instilled into them. He dies now after nearly 3 years as President of the United States, and the Prime Minister's right. So many of the plans, the ideals that he'd formed have not reached fruition, and tragically some of them, I'm afraid, will die with him. But I think the main purpose of his work will go on. Now, what were his achievements? One's got to recognize that in many cases he did not succeed in carrying through what he had set his hand to, partly because of the delays of the American legislative process and for other reasons. But I think what he did achieve was to bring a new sense of purpose to the American people. He did waken up America and get them moving again in an economic sense. He tried, perhaps not all that successfully, though it was not his fault, to get a sense of social purpose into the American political scene, particularly in relation to the welfare for the aged, provision for education. But above all, perhaps, he will be remembered, so far as domestic affairs are concerned, by his great and courageous fight for human rights. His great fight, which once begun, had to go on to the end, for the ending of racial conflict in the United States. His administrative work, I think others will pay tribute to, but at any rate, one can feel that when a decision had to be taken, because of the keen brain, the keen sense of administration he brought, that decision was taken in full light of all the knowledge. Nothing ever went through in a slipshod way. He might make mistakes because all human beings are fallible. But at any rate, every decision was fully documented, and he took his decision with courage and with sincerity. In his overseas relations, I think he has initiated a new era in East-West relationships. He stood firm for American power and for building up American defenses. But he never wanted to employ those defenses in a crusade against those with whom he disagreed. He wanted to build up that strength for the purpose of making peace possible. I was in Russia this year when he made his famous speech to the American University, and I heard, I think I was the first to hear, Premier Khrushchev's reaction to it. What one felt was that the great power of the United States was being used and put forward for reaching a peaceful solution of the problems of East-West relationships. What one felt was that those in America who in past years had talked about the inevitability of war, just as there were those in Russia who talked in those terms, had now been given their quietus by this great and this statesman-like speech. I remember when I met President Kennedy in April, walking round the White House garden with him, and we were talking about history. Because he was a great reader of history books, and he felt, as so many other statesmen have, that you can never really understand the problems of our age except through the eyes of history. And we found we had one favorite book in common, Carl Sandburg's Life of Abraham Lincoln, which both of us seem to know almost by heart, so far as that moving passage about the death of Lincoln was concerned. And as we talked about this, he told me how he'd visited Gettysburg the previous day. Now, in the very week of the centenary of Gettysburg, he too has died. When Lincoln was murdered, one of his closest associates said, "Now he belongs to the ages." I think that is the way in which we shall think of the death of President Kennedy, a young man cut off with only a small fraction of his work completed, but a man who has given an inspiration to those who come after him.
And now the leader of the Liberal Party, Mr. Joe Grimmons.
This is a numbing tragedy. And of course, in the first place, it is a personal tragedy. And I would like to add my sympathy to that of the Prime Minister and the leader of the opposition for President Kennedy's family. He was a natural, charming, gay, vigorous man. And as a man, he has been struck down. And our first thoughts must surely go to his wife and to his children. And again, I think, like other people who have spoken already, that it is appropriate to think at this time of Lincoln, because Kennedy, too, grappled with some of the same difficulties which Lincoln tackled. The difficulty of race relations, the whole difficulty of reaching out as a leader of a free people to meet new problems and new opportunities. And far outside America, Kennedy did stand, not only in the free world, but I think throughout the world, for a new approach to these new problems which we all feel. And I believe in Russia. Tonight there will be genuine sorrow for this appalling act. I don't myself feel that there is much that I can add to what has already been said about him, at least not now. All through Britain there will be quite ordinary people this evening who will feel this as a totally unexpected personal tragedy, as though one of their own relations had been killed. And all we can do is to go on, is to continue to do our bit, to follow on the lines which he had laid down, to build up good relations so far as we can between people of different race and different color, to be firm without being offensive in the protection of our rights and our freedom. And above all, to try and live our political lives, those of us who are in politics, in the same sort of way that he did, with a dedication, but yet with a naturalness, with a lack of pomposity, with the ability to get across to people in a way which I think was peculiarly his own. As I say, he is going to be deeply mourned for a very long time. And tonight all we can do is to send our sympathy to his family and to the great nation which he led.
Mr. Kennedy had been President of the United States for just under 3 years. Let us now go back on film to the autumn of 1960, as John Fitzgerald Kennedy gained the narrow victory which put him into the White House.
It seems little more than yesterday that the young senator from Massachusetts, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, was in the throes of his hectic election campaign right across the United States. By the time Inauguration Day came round, there was already a feeling that change was in the air, radical and refreshing change. Above all, the atmosphere Kennedy created was one of clearing away smugness and self-satisfaction and facing realities, especially unpleasant realities. Together with this, there was a sense of challenge, perhaps even something approaching a crusade.
Life in 1961 will not be easy. Wishing it, predicting it, even asking for it will not make it so. There will be further setbacks before the tide is turned, but turn it we must. In the words of a great president, whose birthday we honor today, closing his final State of the Union message 16 years ago, we pray that we may be worthy of the unlimited opportunities that God has given us.
But the Americans weren't to be the first to realize the unlimited opportunities. It was the Russians. The first real setback to Kennedy's new administration came with Gagarin's space flight, which blazoned Russia's rocket superiority right round the world. Then, 2 days later, the old enemy dealt an even more crushing blow by frustrating the American-aided revolutionaries in their disastrous attack on Cuba. Even if the seeds of this fiasco were sown in Eisenhower's time, the blame fell on Kennedy, and he took it. It was with these two setbacks already behind him that Kennedy set off on his first European tour. It was clear from his reception in Paris that after only 5 months in office, he and his wife had established an almost unquenchable popularity. But it wasn't only to meet the European leaders that he crossed the Atlantic in those early days of his presidency. In Vienna, he had his first meeting with Mr. Khrushchev, not a summit conference, but a chance for the two leaders of the world to sum each other up. And many of their subsequent policies must have been based on the estimates they made of each other then. Later that month, he came to London. That was in June 1961. And now that he is dead, it's extraordinary to realize that this man, who imprinted his stamp on our time so indelibly, did so as President of the United States of America in just 2 years and 10 months.
And that was a tribute to President Kennedy from the BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation, and from the leaders of the various parties in Great Britain, including the Prime Minister. We'll be back with more news involving the succession of the presidency and more news concerning the Kennedy family and the former president in just a moment.
The NBC Radio Network will stay on the air with continuous coverage until 1 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. We will resume broadcasting at 7:30 a.m. Eastern Standard Time Saturday, tomorrow, with continuous coverage. We pause 10 seconds for station identification.
The Detroit news stations, WWJ and WWJ-FM Detroit.
The president was to have delivered an address tonight to the Dallas Citizens Council, the Dallas Assembly, and the Graduate Research Center of the Southwest at the Trade Mart in Dallas. I would like to read you some excerpts from the speech that President Kennedy was to have given. He said, "In a world of complex and continuing problems, in a world full of frustrations and irritations, America's leadership must be guided by the lights of learning and reason, or else those who confuse rhetoric with reality and the plausible with the possible will gain the popular ascendancy with their seemingly swift and simple solutions to every world problem." He spoke of this people, saying there will always be dissident voices heard in the land, expressing opposition without alternatives, finding fault but never favor, perceiving gloom on every side, and seeking influence without responsibility. Those voices are inevitable. But today, other voices are heard in the land, voices preaching doctrines wholly unrelated to reality, wholly unsuited to the 60s, doctrines which apparently assume that words will suffice without weapons, that vituperation is as good as victory, and that peace is a sign of weakness. At a time when the national debt is steadily being reduced in terms of its burden on our economy, they see that debt as the greatest single threat to our security. The president went on and said, "I realize that this nation often tends to identify turning points in world affairs with the major addresses which preceded them. But it was not the Monroe Doctrine that kept all Europe away from this hemisphere. It was the strength of the British fleet and the width of the Atlantic Ocean. It was not General Marshall's speech at Harvard which kept communism out of Western Europe. It was the strength and stability made possible by our military and economic assistance. In this administration also, it has been necessary at times to issue specific warnings, warnings that we could not stand by and watch the communists conquer Laos by force or intervene in the Congo or swallow West Berlin or maintain offensive missiles on Cuba. But while our goals were at least temporarily obtained in these and other instances, our successful defense of freedom was due not to the words we used, but to the strength we stood ready to use on behalf of the principles we stand ready to defend." And he spoke of the different kinds of strength. He spoke of nuclear strength and of our strategic bombers. And then he went on to say, "But the lessons of the last decade have taught us that freedom cannot be defended by strategic nuclear power alone. We have, therefore, in the last 3 years, accelerated the development and deployment of tactical nuclear weapons. Nor can Europe or any other continent rely on nuclear forces alone, President Kennedy would have said, whether they are strategic or tactical. We have radically improved the readiness of our conventional forces, and he went on to describe that readiness and talked about Operation Big Lift, the operation that took so many of our troops more than a division to Europe. American military might, he said, should not and need not stand alone against the ambitions of international communism. Our security and strength, in the last analysis, directly depend on the security and strength of others. Our foreign aid program is not growing in size. It is, on the contrary, smaller now than in previous years, Mr. Kennedy would have said. These are some of the points that he would have made in the speech he was scheduled to deliver tonight in Dallas. What about the future? What about congressional attitudes? And what about the succession of President Johnson to the presidency of the United States and the position in the White House? We have a report on that now from Robert Abernathy in Washington.
Although Lyndon Johnson has become president, no one under our system of succession automatically moves up now to vice president. John McCormick of Massachusetts, Speaker of the House of Representatives, 72 years old, would now become president should Lyndon Johnson die. But Mr. McCormick does not automatically become vice president, nor does he expect to assume additional duties, for instance, on those occasions when the new president might be away from Washington. President Johnson met Speaker McCormick and the other leaders of the House and Senate this evening. Mr. Johnson was described afterwards by one who was there as humble and chastened. The Republican leader of the Senate, Everett Dirksen, said earlier this evening that he thought Congress would not change its plan to continue work until December 20th. There are appropriations bills, for instance, which must be passed. Other Capitol leaders echo this feeling. "I think we should carry on," one said. "Congress must show the world continuity." Congressional leaders know Lyndon Johnson well. They remember him as an effective Senate leader, not afraid to make decisions. Tonight, they expect Congress to work with him sympathetically, giving him every chance they can to become accustomed to his new burdens. This is Robert Abernathy, NBC News, Washington.
The telegrams of condolences from the countries of the free world and some of the countries of the communist world continue to pour in. From France, a message from the French Premier, Monsieur Georges Pompidou, to President Lyndon Johnson said, "Deeply moved by the tragic loss experienced by the United States on the death of President Kennedy, whose courage and great gifts as a statesman were admired by all the French people. I wish to convey to you the grief felt by all my fellow countrymen. Rest assured that at a time when under such cruel circumstances you take up your high office, my colleagues of the French government and myself join with you in a feeling of most grieving and most loyal friendship." Everyone, you get the feeling, searches for words to try to find them, to try and find the right ones to show the strength of our feelings. Everyone all over the world, and it's extremely difficult, but the feelings are all there. A telegram to Mrs. Kennedy from General Douglas MacArthur said, "I realize the utter futility of words at such a time, but the world of civilization shares the poignancy of this monumental tragedy. As a former comrade in arms," said General Douglas MacArthur, "his death kills something within me." And of course, General MacArthur was the supreme commander, a man of great renown, and during the World War, at the time when the former president was a rather minor lieutenant junior grade in charge of a PT boat. The governor of New Jersey, Governor Hughes, a Democrat, also had a reaction to this tragedy. Let's hear that now.
"I share with my countrymen today a shock and grief which defies description. A young and fearless American has died in the service of his country, even as many years ago his body absorbed the wounds of battle in the name of freedom. Now John Kennedy belongs to history, and his courageous spirit joins the fellowship of those who never flinched in the doing of right and in the search for justice. May God bless him and his family, and the America he loves so deeply. To President Johnson, now assuming the burdens of an office on which rest the hopes of all humanity, go the prayers and dedication of every one of us."
And that was Governor Richard Hughes of New Jersey. Another statement, which is, well, certainly interesting, comes from the American Communist Party. The address is given as 23 West 26th Street in New York City. The statement referred to this dastardly crime and said it was the ultimate depravity of the pro-fascist ultra-right forces. I'll give you the quote in more detail. It is the ultimate depravity of the pro-fascist ultra-right forces of the fiendish Dixiecrats and racists who will stop at nothing to destroy the democratic institutions of the country, to threaten the peace of the world, and to turn back the clock of history. This seems to be the communists following the Soviet line. As you heard earlier from NBC's John Chancellor in West Berlin, the official communist line with which they were stuck, because they made the statements before we actually had any details, was to the effect that there was a rightist organization and rightist individuals who had been responsible for the shooting of President Kennedy. The later information, of course, seems to indicate otherwise, that it was, in fact, an individual whose sympathies lay quite strongly with the communists and their cause. But the American Communist Party is following along the lines laid down by it, for it, by their communist masters elsewhere. A statement from Senator Barry Goldwater, the Republican conservative from Arizona, mentioned, of course, frequently as a possible Republican candidate and the man who many people think would have been the opponent to President Kennedy in the next year's election, was that it is both shocking and dreadful that a thing like this could happen in a free country. Senator Goldwater learned of the president's death at a Chicago airport. He was flying to Indiana for the funeral of his mother-in-law, Mrs. Ann Davis Johnson. He telephoned a statement to his Washington Senate office. Senator Goldwater said, "The president's death is a profound loss to the nation and the free world. He and I were personal friends. It is also a great loss to me. Mrs. Goldwater and I offer our heartfelt sympathies to Mrs. Kennedy and the president's family." High officials, governors, and senators from all over the country are trying to express their regret, and their sincere regret and misery over this terrible thing. And we have now a statement issued by Governor James Davis of the state of Louisiana.
"I'm shocked that such a thing as this could happen in this country in this day and age. This is murder in its most vile form. The warped mind that causes crime apparently felt that political questions were involved. But the basic issue is whether the President of the United States, or for that matter any individual, can be free to express his views without having to sacrifice his life. Differences of opinion can be settled at the ballot boxes. And to depart from this is to depart from morality and democracy alike, and undermines everything this country stands for. I am sorry for the president's family, and I extend to President Johnson my best wishes to him during the difficult and trying times ahead."
And from Governor Cal Rolvag of Minnesota, this statement.
"The grief and the great sense of loss all Americans are experiencing at the death of our president. Thousands of Minnesotans have thrilled to his presence in our state and have rallied to the great ideals he represented and fought for on behalf of all Americans. Throughout America and throughout Minnesota tonight, there is a deep sorrow that this most fearless and determined of leaders has not been allowed to see the fruition of his dream, the total emancipation and loosening of the spirit of all human beings everywhere in the world. I'm certain that countless millions extend their anguished sympathy to the president's family and friends. In consolation, we can say that the spirit of President Kennedy will live on. His principles, his devotion to the welfare of all people, cannot be stilled by the warped minds that launched his assassin's bullet. For what his assassin and those like him do not understand is that you can never kill that which is just, or kill that which is right, or still that which seeks to ennoble and uplift the existence of all men. There is great anger in our hearts tonight, but I'm certain that if the president had lived, he would have said, 'Let us have pity on this man.'"
How's that?
Governor Rolvag of Minnesota. Just in this information, President Kennedy's body will be brought from Bethesda Naval Hospital to the White House sometime during the night. This according to Acting Presidential Press Secretary Andrew Hatcher. The body will lie there in repose on a platform called a catafalque, similar to the one, in fact, which was used for President Lincoln, who fell to an assassin's bullet in 1865. Mr. Hatcher said the body now is in the care of Gawler's funeral home. Undertakers of this establishment are preparing the body for burial at the Bethesda Naval Hospital, according to Mr. Hatcher. Speaking of the White House, we have some information from there concerning the new president and the problems he faces and the other problems attendant. From NBC's Richard Valeriani, we join him now at the White House.
The White House has just announced that the body of President Kennedy will be brought sometime tonight to the East Room of the White House, where it will lie in repose through tomorrow. There it will be viewed by the new president, Lyndon Johnson, members of the late president's family, and other high-ranking officials of the government and diplomatic representatives in the Capitol. The White House said that the body will rest on a raised platform, a catafalque, similar to the one used for President Abraham Lincoln, who was also assassinated about 100 years ago. An honor guard will be in continuous attendance. The catafalque will be flanked by two lighted candles. The coffin containing President Kennedy's remains is now at Bethesda Naval Hospital. That is where the widow, Mrs. Kennedy, is spending the night. She will return to the White House in the morning. These other bits of information became available just a short while ago. The White House said that for the time being, President Johnson will work in the more familiar surroundings of his vice presidential offices in the executive office building across the street from the White House. The six cabinet members who were on their way to Japan for economic talks and then turned around when they heard of the president's assassination are now scheduled to arrive shortly after midnight in Washington. They'll view the body in repose tomorrow, and Secretary of State Dean Rusk is scheduled to meet with the new president at 9:30 in the morning. This is Richard Valeriani, NBC News, at the White House in Washington.
Other news in connection with the shooting and in connection with the world and its reception of the news. Texas Governor John Connally, who was wounded today during the assassination of President Kennedy, is now described as being in good condition. A spokesman at the Parkland Hospital in Dallas says the governor still does not know the president is dead. Governor Connally underwent a four-hour chest operation after he was wounded this afternoon. An aide says he came to and asked for his wife, and then he asked her about their children. Doctors report the governor is, quote, mentally alert and comfortable, although he has not yet asked about Mr. Kennedy. The bullet which wounded him entered his right shoulder and then emerged through his chest. One rib had to be removed during surgery and a cut lung repaired. But again, we repeat this one piece of good news, that the governor of Texas, Mr. John Connally, is described by medical spokesman as being in good condition. Telling the world about the news, Radio Liberty opened up all of its 18 transmitters with close to 2 million watts of power today to bring all aspects of President Kennedy's assassination to its large audience, or anticipated large audience, within the Soviet Union. Their programming at Radio Liberty is in Russian and in 16 other languages, and is now being carried on repeatedly, giving a future profile of the new president, Lyndon Johnson, which assures Soviet citizens that the administration's current policies will continue as before. And this is confirmed by other sources, anticipating from Mr. Johnson's statements in a variety of fields and at a variety of times that he is as one with the former president in the area of foreign policy. Radio Liberty has been broadcasting a special feature to the world and to the Soviet Union on the peaceful transition of authority to the new president in accordance with constitutional procedures. This, of course, presents an obvious contrast to the way there have been successions in the Soviet Union and in other communist countries. The program shows the orderliness of government processes during emergencies such as that of today. All Russians will take this to heart, remembering the death of Stalin and the jockeying for power and the murder and eventually the final survival of one candidate alone, Mr. Khrushchev, after the elimination of all of his rivals. Other special programs now being repeated on all Radio Liberty channels include excerpts from President Kennedy's American University speech in Washington, D.C. last June, which was considered by many as a significant contribution to world understanding. It's generally thought that that speech, the one delivered by President Kennedy at American University, was the speech which eventually led to the partial nuclear test ban treaty. Mr. Johnson grimly assumed the burdens of the presidency tonight and in an immediate flurry of activity won a pledge of bipartisan congressional cooperation in the dark days that followed, that will follow President Kennedy's assassination. Speaking of congressional reaction, we have a substantial amount of it here, which I'll pass on to you. My God, what are we coming to? These were the only words that Speaker John McCormick could utter when he was told of the death of the president. Senate Democratic Leader Mike Mansfield immediately summoned all senators to the floor for a special period of prayer while the president was dying. He called the slaying not only a great tragedy for the nation, but it is, I think, he said, a mark against the respectability and responsibility of some of our citizens. Senate Republican Leader Everett Dirksen, on learning of a shooting, could only exclaim, "Oh, God, this is the most distressing thing that could ever happen." After the president died, Senator Dirksen still could barely summon words. He called the crime incredible and told newsmen, "I'm a little bewildered, as I know the nation and the whole world will be." Of the assassin, Dirksen said, "The gates of hell must have been concealed and congealed inside of him." He mourned Senator President Kennedy as the victim of a violent and indescribable hate. Senator Margaret Chase Smith, Republican of Maine, who has known Mr. Kennedy both in the House and in the Senate, burst into tears when she was told the news while eating lunch. There was anger against the perpetrator of the killing, as well as mourning and eulogy for the dead president. Senator Richard Russell, leader of the Senator's Southern Bloc, called it a dastardly crime. He said the assassination's bullet has stricken a brilliant and dedicated statesman at the very height of his power. And speaking of Georgia and of reaction from that state, we have here a statement from Governor Carl Sanders of the state of Georgia.
"I'm sure that I speak for all Georgians, as well as Americans and free men everywhere, in expressing my deep regret over the untimely passing of our President John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Not only has the country been robbed of a dynamic leader, but I also feel a deep personal loss. It had been my pleasure and privilege to know the president as a friend. He was deeply concerned about the welfare of all people everywhere. No one has been a stronger and more dedicated fighter for freedom for all the people. Ms. Sanders and I extend our personal grief and sympathy to Mrs. Kennedy and the president's family. We are confident in our faith that Almighty God in His infinite mercy will give them the strength necessary to withstand the sadness of the passing of husband and father. They, as all Americans, can take renewed hope in the sacrifice that has been made by this great American, whose devotion to his country has been answered to its last full measure."
Mrs. Jacqueline Kennedy, we are informed, was under her doctor's care tonight at Bethesda Naval Hospital in suburban Maryland, where she accompanied her husband's body. Dr. John Walsh, Mrs. Kennedy's personal physician, was at Andrews Air Force Base in nearby Maryland to be on hand when the presidential jet plane landed, and he remained at the hospital with Mrs. Kennedy tonight. But there is somebody waiting who knows more about these things and of the affairs generally taking place in Washington. So let's call in now NBC's Robert Abernathy in Washington.
Funeral details are being handled by a private Washington undertaker, Joseph Gollar's Sons, Incorporated. At 4:25 this afternoon, this firm was requested to prepare the president's body. Tonight, four men from Gollar's went to the Bethesda Naval Hospital, where the president's body was taken from the airport. With them went a mahogany casket and a so-called church truck, a support for the casket. Specific arrangements have at no time been firm. It had been thought that the president's body would be brought to the funeral home en route to the White House. Two dozen Washington policemen were detailed to the home. So was a five-man honor guard, one enlisted man each from the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps, and Coast Guard. Their job would have been to guard the room in which the president's body might have lain. But now that plan has been changed. The president's body, professionally prepared, is now expected to be taken directly to the White House tonight. At the funeral home, the honor guard waits to be told to go home, and on the lighted board on which are written the names of those for whom the home is arranging funerals, there is written in crayon in this order, Mrs. Detmer, Mrs. Farnham,
President Kennedy. This is Robert Abernethy, NBC News, Washington.